Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, and welcome to Outcasts with David, No One Leaves Baby in the Corner, Barry, and High Chief Oompa Loompa, Tim Downey. Hark! The cuckoo. The bringer of spring and good tidings. What? What's that you say? Oh. He tells of a great city, buried deep in the hills, a place of great mystery and magic, they say. An Avalon, carved from the bedrock, somewhere just off the M80. Our guide to the high adventure that awaits us is someone who, without whom, none of this would exist. She is development and executive producer at Tall Ship Productions, along with Ron D. Moore, and has produced some of the most wonderful and beloved shows out there. Battlestar Galactica, Electric Dreams, two of my personal favorites, and of course, the extraordinary Outlander. She is the very brilliant Maryl Davis. Hello, Maryl, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. I think I might hire you as my agent. I love that intro. Thank you. So it makes me sound much more important than I am.
That's ridiculous. You are that important. You might not be such a creature of the woodland glade as that, but important nonetheless. So, well, first off, how have you been? How's lockdown been treating you?
I'm actually doing pretty well, I have to admit. I unlike most people, do not mind being homebound. Obviously, ready to kind of go out and eat and do all those things, and certainly worried about people who are sick and everything's going on. But in general, keeping myself busy and doing well.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Now, as traditional on this show, you have picked a scene for us, which will be, it's from season one, episode four, scene four. Now, normally, you are indeed the person in charge of things, but today, the tables have turned, and we, Mr. David Berry and myself, are the producers. David is the Zero Mostel to my Gene Wilder. Very happy with that. So I warn you, we obviously have absolutely no idea what we're doing. So just, I just want to put that right out right there, just so we're all in the same, boat.
But I'm very upset about that. I thought I get to choose parts. I think I'm so used to holding on to that.
Well, that's exactly what you are going to do, because I, as producer now, I am going to delegate that to you. And we are also going to create a lot of high production value with this. So seemingly out of nothing, as there is pretty much nothing in this room that is useful, but I have created certain little things. So we're going to do a few little sound effects every now and then, something to look forward to. A little bit of music, we'll underscore, it's going to be great. Soundscapes, really give the scene a lift, and maybe even a song or two. I'm just throwing it out there. But first of all, yes, so if you could just give us a little bit about why you chose this particular scene.
Well, I'll be honest. I've listened to a few episodes of the podcast and knew what to expect and thought I'd go back to the beginning, since I felt like so many people chose from four or five seasons. So started in season one and honestly got too tired to go back to episode four. And I always have loved this scene. It's funny and obviously not as a writer myself, nor an actor. I wasn't going to choose a scene depending on those two things. So it's kind of hard to pick your favorite. It's like picking a favorite child. So this one always makes me laugh. It has three roles, which I thought was perfect. So that's about all of the thought that went into it.
We're learning here. We're learning. And that's how a producer chooses a scene. We'll know from next time.
You get too tired to go past four episodes.
It's the honesty I like. So how are we going to divvy up? So we've got a Claire, we have Rupert and Angus. So who do you see in those roles?
Well, I'm obviously going to be American Claire, because I'm not even going to attempt to do an accent. I'm rubbish. It's hard. Rupert, Angus. I mean, I'm going to go Tim. I'm going to give you Angus and Rupert, David, it's all yours.
Great.
Awesome. Now, David, would you, as is, you know, it's the beginning of a scene. Do you want to give us a little song? I can happily lead with maybe like the last verse of Skyboat song. You can happily follow my lead.
Oh dear.
Okay.
Well, David is a singer. David's going to blow this out of the water. So do you know the lyrics?
We should. Well, let's find out. I actually don't think I do.
Sing me a song of a lass that is gone.
Right. No. Let's paint the picture. We've got to get a big production value here, right? The credits come up. Okay. Set my mood. Get me going.
Little bit of skyboat, just to lead you in. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Are you ready for my lead?
Yeah. Go.
Okay. Ready. Yeah. Sing me a song of a lass that is gone.
Say
could that last be I?
Some
Mary of soul, she sailed on a day
drums.
Over the sea to sky fade in.
Yeah, that's
exterior
it.
Temporary gathering encampment continuous as Claire and her watchman approach a courtier. She notices a Rubenesque woman, 30s-ish, cooking at a campfire. So
I got campfire sound. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's great.
The woman's periodic glances at, of all people, Angus. The first catches Claire's attention, or is she looking at Rupert? Claire's not quite sure. She pulls up short and wheels round to face Rupert and Angus.
Can I just, before I start, say quickly apologies to Katrina Bell for this rendition and apologies to Matt Roberts, who wrote this lovely scene. I'm about to butcher it. Please do not look, but that lovely lady stirring the kettle seems to fancy one of you.
I thought that was good, actually. There's no need for apologies there.
Great. Wait,
you have to say that.
No, I don't. I don't really. Well, I am the producer. I could fire you here. But
that's true. Which you should. There's a reason I'm behind the camera and you're about to find out why.
Okay. All right. Sorry, Tim.
No problem. They immediately look over Claire's shoulder.
I asked you not to look.
I'm Rupert, right?
Yes.
Okay. Great.
Good start.
This is a multi-million dollar production here. Adding production value here. Aye, she's a paiter, that one.
Rupert begins to take a step forward excitedly. Okay, here we go.
Well, I'll just be settling my cock to roost in that tonight.
But he's instantly thwarted by Angus's arm. Nae so fast. We said every man for himself during the gathering.
Aye, we did. But you ken how much I fancy a hen with a bit of meat.
Who does ne? Seeing a way to engender goodwill, Claire kneels, picks up a twig from the ground and snaps it in two pieces. It's the only thing I had. It's the closest to wood. Mm-hmm. She's careful with the next. Never quite sure how to read Angus. He's nitroglycerine. Too much jostling and he might explode.
Gentlemen, may I be of assistance here?
Claire holds out her hand, displaying two sticks.
I realize I'm a captive audience of sorts, but I'd rather not be subjected to another one of your inane debates. If you please, draw sticks. Long one gets to ply their charms on the woman there. The other, well, I guess we'll have the pleasure of accompanying me.
Rupert and Angus share a look and in some unspoken language agree that it's actually not a bad idea, though it pains Angus to nod in agreement. Claire turns her back and evens out the two pieces, then swings around, extending her arm.
Choose.
I feel like we should have some sort of like suspenseful music here, like dun, 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 and then keep reading it. Get that big print going. Dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun, Rupert is quick to the draw, snatching a piece from her close fist before Angus can even lift his hand.
Does all your wanking? Sorry.
Does all your wanking?
Dun, 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 dun. Keep going.
Does all your wanking gives you that much speed of hand?
It's getting more suspenseful.
The twig Rupert holds has good length, but Claire reveals an even longer section in her palm, which elicits a wide smile from Angus and a growl from Rupert. I'll save you some pay. Angus is off straight away toward the woman's camps. Rupert snarls, having come out on the short end of both the draw and the joke.
The seed planted, I now needed to tend to the other elements of my plan. I'll need a horse for tomorrow's hunt. The laird wants a healer along just in case. Dun dun dun.
Rupert grunts a reply in Gaelic. One can only imagine. End scene. Fabulous.
Wow.
of a land that is gone. Say it again. I could just drift off.
It's actually shocking that we didn't ask you two to do a duet of that Lean In song. It really is. I'm actually regretting that right now.
Hey, plenty of time. Plenty of time. Now, there are a lot of misconceptions and misunderstandings about what it means to be a producer. And I think many people see producers as remote, sort of shadowy figures of power and influence, focused just on the money, very little involvement with the creative process. But that is not the case. That's not true. So for all the people at home, can you help us to understand your job as a producer?
I mean, I don't even understand it myself. It's one of the hardest questions to answer. I get asked this all the time. What does a producer do? And there are so many variations on the title. And quite honestly, I do think the people who are line producers, as they are known, the people who deal with the scheduling and the budgets and the hiring, firing of most of your crew, those are the people that, to me, in my mind, are the real producers. I'm what they call creative non-writing producer, and that I don't write. And most of the producers on our show also are writers. So it means various things. I mean, for me, I sit in on the writer's room, writing stories if I can. I oversee with other writers like Tony and Matt casting. I liaison with the studio and the network. I weigh in on hiring of HODs. And that kind of stuff, and hire writers.
Heads of department.
Although we do them call them department heads in the States. Various other such duties. I oversee marketing and licensing and publicity.
You never set out to be a producer. I read that you wanted to play soccer.
Yes.
Originally, which is fascinating because that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And I think, from what I read, you actually suffered the same injury that I suffered from, which you did a knee in.
Yes, yes. I was I didn't want to grow up wanting to be a soccer player. I have played soccer all my life. I started when I was 5 and loved it. But I'm old enough that, when I was going to college, they didn't really have MA soccer programs and certainly didn't have a professional league in the States. So I just went to college, played all 4 years, started working at Star Trek, and then kind of after 5 or 6 years there, didn't know what I wanted to do. And they had started a women's professional league. So I thought, you know what, before I'm too old to get out of my chair, I'm going to train to play soccer. Moved home, much to the chagrin of all of these young whippersnappers I was training with who were like, wait a second, you had a job in Los Angeles, you were living on your own, and now you're living at home again? They're like, we don't get it. And then I trained for about a year and then got invited to try out for the team in Boston. And 2 days before the tryout, before they were going to fly me out, I blew out my knee.
Oh.
So.
Wait, what position? What position were you?
I was a forward. I don't know what Tim was.
I was goalkeeper. Goalkeeper. Ah. And I came out. It was a long ball. My injury, long ball. Run out, slid down, and then the forward who was running towards me decided I'm not having any of that, and then slid his heel into my knee and cracked my knee. It was an Arsenal player. I think that says it all.
Oh man!
Very unpleasant, and that was the end of that.
Yikes.
Well, we could almost get 11. We should start an Outlander soccer team. I think there's a few other cast members at play. I'll be a general manager. I don't want to throw any knees out.
Are you athletic at all, David?
I will take no offense at that question. I am.
Don't know. That wasn't actually a diss. It was just out of curiosity. I would have no idea.
I'm a bit sensitive, I guess. well, if it were up to me, I'd be starting a basketball team, not a soccer team, or a football team. Talk two pylons is there, Tim. Soccer, football. I know it's a tricky one.
It's a very touchy subject in this country. It's football. No other word. It doesn't matter what else you call it. People go, I don't know what. It's like you know what it is, but you're just going to refuse to acknowledge it in this country. It's football. Simple as that. Jumpers for goalposts. Things like, yes, that's football.
No, I never had like a heroic like tale of how I wanted to be a professional athlete and then some... tragic accident stopped me from my dreams. I wish that were the case. I wish I had that, but no, I just a casual sportsman, I guess. You know, odd pickup, and that's why I'm trying to have a casual game of Outlander soccer. It's, you know, it's not getting too serious. You guys taking everything too serious here. That's why I ended up with injury. No slide tackling for me.
None of that. And I can see it being quite a friendly game between the English and the Scots. I can't see any animosity whatsoever with that.
None at all.
I believe they were just kind of really just, you know, have a bit of fun with it. So you bust your knee and you're thinking, I've probably got to go and do something else now. So what takes you from, I'm very happy with this one, what takes you from one pitch to end up in another pitch? It's quite very happy with that. Very happy.
Nice
with
that. Segue. That was smooth.
So thank you. I'm very pleased. So that middle period between joining Ron and Toolship, how did you get from, you've just done a little bit on Star Trek, you come away from that. So how did you get back into it? How did you think, right, okay, I'm going to pursue this avenue now?
Well, I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to obviously get back into television because, you know, I'd really loved it when I'd started there. And I didn't know exactly that I wanted to produce, but I kind of knew just because I'm very nosy and I like sticking my hands in a lot of different things. And I ran into Ron at a party randomly, and I had worked for Ron. Some people don't know this, but I'd worked for Ron for 3 months back at Star Trek. And this was when Ron was not a showrunner. He was lower down on the pole, totem pole, and he was great. I just had moved on to work for the showrunner at Star Trek and a couple other people. And when I ran into him at a party, he was like, you know, my assistant is leaving. Do you want to come work with me? I'm working on a show called Carnival.
Can I hold the phone for 1 second? I got to ask you, like, how do you run into Ron at a party?
Well,
what parties are these? Are just a Hollywood party?
Well, it was. And I'm not necessarily a Hollywood partier, but we knew a lot of the same people at Star Trek. So it was a Star Trek party. So so I ran into him there. And I said, I'd love to come work for you, but I've done the assistant thing. I put in my years there. I'm ready to kind of move on and progress. And he said, come with me. We'll figure it out. And we did. And, you know, now we're producing partners. And we did Battlestar Galactica and then various other pilots and ended up here at Outlanderville.
What sort of common interests do you and Ron share? What makes you a good partnership? So, in other words, I mean, I think you've spoken about how one does what the other one can't.
Yes, yeah.
And vice versa.
I don't know if the other one can't, but it's more what does Ron not want to do? That's kind of how it started out. You know, Ron, there are certain things that he's so good at, obviously, writing. He loves editing, things like that. You know, he loves everyone, but he's not necessarily going to want to talk to the studio network on a daily basis when he can be writing. He doesn't, you know, necessarily weigh in too much on casting, marketing, publicity, those kind of things. So I just kind of picked up the slack there and started doing those things and found that we had a good balance there. And I think we share a lot of the same sensibilities. We have similar sense of humor and kind of go for the same things in stories, but also have enough differences that for instance, Outlander came from that. You know, it was something I was really passionate about. It would not have been something he would have picked up on his own, but he is really amazing with strong female characters and just strong drama and characters in general. So I knew he would love it. So it was Outlander, I think, is a perfect example of a good pairing between the two of us.
I think that's the secret of a good relationship, especially in business, you know, or in even just having a little podcast where you chat.
I disagree.
You see, there you go. You see, straight away he's in there. I knew it.
Well, I'd like to actually know how this partnership evolved. I mean, were you guys just sitting on set in one of those sad little tents and just said, you know what, podcast, you and me? How did this happen?
Well, we were at a Hollywood party. Ron Moore was there.
Star Trek party.
I didn't
see this.
We've never told this story. I don't
know. No, we haven't. Well, please take the floor. I will jump in.
Well, where did we meet Tim? I actually can't remember.
I think we, because we'd met a few times on series 4, but very, very fleetingly, kind of little sort of hellos at table reads. But then we properly met.
You might have said hello to me and I might have ignored you. I don't know.
I think he did that. I may have said, could I just get those wagon wheels from that craft table? And he said, no.
I think I asked you for a tea, actually. Exactly. I think I asked you if you could get me a coffee. I think that was
I flatly refused. But I think it was season five, and it was Jocasta's wedding, and we were in those little white tents, and it was about three or four that were just, you know, down by the river. And I think that was the first time we just kind of sat down, because we were in the tent together, and had a kind of chat and things like that. And we actually found out that we actually have a mutual love of violin music. As David was saying, what are you listening to on your iPhone? And you played me some violin music. And I said, you should listen to this.
That's unusual, because I'm not...
See, look, he doesn't even care, Meryl. See?
Is that what a love blossom for you, Tim, but obviously not for David?
Oh, I remember the details, Meryl.
I can't believe you guys met so late.
I know, I'd say that every day, all this wasted.
It feels like we've known each other. It feels like an old married couple.
Exactly. Well, we were ships in the night, high school sweethearts that kind of never met, broke up at prom, that kind of thing.
We bicker a lot, Tim. Well, Meryl, you said you don't really know what a producer is, and I just wanted to help you out here because I did my own research. Believe it or not, I went to the U.S. Bureau of Labor and Statistics for this one. And they said that the most important attributes for a movie or TV producer are talent, experience, business acumen, and the ability to deal with many different kinds of different people. Importantly, under stress. And I wanted to talk about this last one for a second, because I think that sounds like the real clinch here, the real interesting one. The ability to deal with many different kinds of people under stress. And believe me, I can't think of anything more stressful than working with actors who don't know who they are on the best of days and play many different kinds of people for a living. And I wanted to ask you what it's like to deal with actors. I mean, Tim finds me difficult enough to deal with.
This is true.
We actors carry, you know, a reputation for sometimes being difficult, on set tantrums, not turning up to late on set and all that kind of stuff. I'm wondering if this is, what's your experience been with this, and how have you learned to deal with actors?
This feels like a loaded question that I'm almost scared to answer, but, we'll
just throw a tantrum and hang out in our trailer if anything goes wrong.
Exactly. I'll be honest. I actually have been very lucky that I have not worked with many actors that I can even recall that have been difficult. I mean, I do think Ron and I, traditionally on our sets, do require and like to have sets that there's mutual respect going around. You know, it's always an interesting balance, I think, more so between actors and writers, I would say, just because, you know, writers are writing material and actors are acting that material. And I think we're all very sensitive to the fact that acting is a very vulnerable profession. I wouldn't want in my daily life people to give me notes on what I was doing. But that kind of is also our job to, you know, we know the material very well. The writers have often obviously written the material. The actors feel like they know the material very well because they're acting it, and they have now imbued that character with their own characteristics in some ways. So I think there's always a push-pull there in some ways of trying to come to common ground. Because I think at the end of the day, we all own the character. I do think, you know, from an actor perspective, I imagine there's an ownership there, and you have to have part of that ownership to play that character in a way that you master it. But I think we feel that as well on the other side, the writers and the producers. So I think for us, it's trying to navigate that and making an actor feel, rightly so, that they are guardians of that character, but also trying to fit in our perspective on that character as well. I know that was kind of a roundabout way of talking about it, but I think for the most part, I've had really good luck. I mean, you treat someone with respect and hopefully you get that back. And we try to create sets that are happy places to be. It does get stressful sometimes and tempers flare, but for the most part, I have not found that we've had anyone that we've worked with that has been a unique problem. I think that would be really problematic for us if it got too crazy. I don't know if that answered the question.
No, it does. Tim on his trailer, we usually have signs as Lord John Grey, Jamie Fraser. Tim has unique problem on his door. It says unique problem. Yeah. So we all know who he is.
And the door's usually torn off and it knows why.
Is it written on the other side of somebody else's placard? Because I find often we reuse those. So makes people feel good.
Talking about difficult actors, I remember a very quick story about a friend of mine. And who
Sam Hewitt?
No, it's a friend of mine, not Sam Heughan. Not Sam Heughan. Imagine if you suddenly go, yes, I remember that story very well. It happened season two.
He is lovely, just for that. He is lovely.
He is absolutely lovely. But yeah, so a friend of mine was on set, and he was young at the time, and decided to go out, have a bit of a big night, as young actors can do. He then missed his call completely. The next day, it was a 6 o'clock call, missed it completely. And I think he woke up at like 9 to 400 missed calls. Why on earth? People banging on the door going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, what am I doing? And so it took him so long that the next day he bought 2 ice cream vans to arrive on set to say, yeah, I'm very sorry that happened.
Yeah.
And I, as an actor, I yearn for the day that there's an ice cream van on set. Not if I'm hanging around for 4 or 5 hours. But yeah, so it can get quite, yeah, difficult actors can be quite strange.
Yeah, but I also think from an actor perspective, I'm sure you look at us as producers, those of us who are, and that, you know, there is kind of a, I imagine, why are you guys telling us what to do? Why do you think you know the character better? I mean, I would be interested to hear from your perspective how you guys find dealing with producers.
Hmm. Oh. Oh.
Wow. Throwing the tables around. Well,
David, I think you have a few things to say about this.
I do. Let me get started. You've just opened a whole can of worms here, Meryl. Let me get on my soapbox. I think you answered it really diplomatically, and I think that's part of the whole thing. It is a diplomacy that you have to execute between actors and producers, because sometimes it can be an us versus them mentality, and there is a power differential. Like obviously the producer has the ultimate say at the end of the day, but then, you know, actors like to try and flex their muscle a little bit and about ownership of, you know, who's making the calls. And I think as a show progresses and actors get more comfortable in their roles, and maybe producers get more comfortable in their roles, you know, it can become even more contentious about, you know, who's making the creative decisions. I think we all want to be masters of our creative destiny. And I think actors tend to indulge their creativity a little bit. And we tend to think just because we're creative, that gives us an entitlement to make a lot of, you know, sometimes very indulgent choices about what we want to do on set or what our character wants to do. And I think it's always up to we always have to defer to the producer to make that referee's call at the end of the day. Bring that back to soccer. Having a bit of someone adjudicating the calls. And I think problems can occur when that hierarchy is not respected. What do you think on that, Tim?
I think the same. I think also the actor sometimes lives in a bubble.
Yeah.
And the actor is very much aware of what they are doing and in that moment at that time. But for the sheer scope and arc of where a story is going to go and the kind of grand universal world that character sits in, a lot of the time the actor has absolutely no idea. So they can be pernickety about certain little details, when in the grand scheme of things, go, well, actually, you can't do that, because if you do that, then you don't know what will happen in episode 15 or whatever, or however the character will generate, especially with something I imagine when it's a book such as this, there is the story is there, the bones are there. And so if an actor suddenly says, well, actually, I don't think he is going to ride over that ridge, you go, well, if you don't ride over that ridge, then X or, you know, this or this is not going to happen. Or if you don't say this line in that way to that person, then it's going to have repercussions sort of later on.
I also think that I imagine that one of the real skills of being a producer is harnessing all these creative people, harnessing the creative potential of actors and of a camera department, of writers who have lots of ideas, and then focusing them. You know, sometimes you see actors do their best work when they're working with a producer, because that producer really understands their talent or really understands that writer's talent, and they know how to really get the best out of their cast and their crew and their creators.
No, I think that's true. I think that's the role of the showrunner ultimately. You know, I mean, in that position, you want to have a person that's like your general. I mean, it's the difference of, you know, wanting to follow someone into battle or not. And you want to have someone who can rally everyone together, because it's all about, you know, the spirit on set and everyone having a good time. We're not curing cancer here. And I think that's important to remember. Sometimes it feels like we are on set, but, you know, I'm the first to remind everyone and myself that this is actually one of the more fun things you can do in life. And it's not, at the end of the day, life or death.
Yeah, my parents constantly remind me of that. Both doctors, my dad's a cancer doctor. You're not cancer. Don't worry about your problems. You're not problems. I'm a cancer doctor. But
oh man,
I want to move on to another relationship here. These stressful relationships, because other than dealing with actors, I think another stressful relationship would be one of dealing with studios and networks. Another bunch of very strong personalities, and this time they can get you fired. How do you manage that, Meryl?
I'm actually hugely lucky that I love the people I work with. I mean, particularly at Starz, Karen Bailey is my day-to-day go-to person, and I absolutely adore her. And I'm not just saying that. She is someone that I have known since the beginning, who has been such a fan, such a partner to me in this journey. I love her. And same at Sony, starting with Chris Parnell, who sadly is leaving to go to Apple. I feel like he's abandoning us, but he, from the get-go, was such a fan and such a true partner, and everyone at Sony and Starz. So that actually has been a relationship for me that's been lovely, and that I find those relationships quite easy. I think the difficulty is obviously if they call you and they don't like someone's hairdo in dailies, or they don't, you know, like something, you know, script-wise. We get a lot of notes, obviously, and certainly it's Matt's job as the showrunner to disseminate all the notes that are coming in from production, actors, studio network, other producers. It's a difficult job to take all of those, which are often contradictory, and figure out, you know, what the best path is. So I think that's it. It's like a mediator. That's what I feel like. I'm a mediator.
Do you have an example of some of those notes that you get?
Oh God, I can't even. They're just, I can't think of something offhand, but once again, it's rare that different groups don't contradict each other. You know, once again, we get notes from studio and network, Diana, sometimes the actors, directors, production, it's other producers. I mean, I weigh in all the time. I don't get my notes taken all the time. I don't like it, but it's it's what happens. You know, we all think we're right at the end of the day. That's the problem. We all think our way is the best way. And why are we not getting our way? And so I think that is quite a masterful job to be able to take everyone's notes and distill it down to something that goes on the page. I think that's one of the harder jobs, actually. My job feels fairly easy.
Seems like you'd have to set aside your ego a lot.
Yes. Best idea wins. That's what we say in the room anyway, normally.
Well, I heard, speaking of Karen Bailey, she told me an interesting story about how you guys pitched the show to Starz. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you got this show up with Ron, and how that pitch with Karen and everyone at Starz happened with Outlander being picked up?
Yeah, well, I don't want to bore you with the long lead up story, but we pitched it around town basically. And as you know, at the time there were seven books, I guess, at the time. And they're huge. I mean, all of Diana's books are really long. And so everywhere we go, we just bring in the entire stack of books and we just put it on the table just to be like, look at all this amazing material we have. Like, we're not going to run out. We'll all probably be dead before we get through all this material, type of thing. So, and actually of all the places we pitched this, and we pitched it to HBO, Showtime, all of those kind of normal people around town, Starz was the only place we went to that not only, were they obviously the most interested and were willing to do the books as they were, and they weren't asking us to go off book, but they had all read the first book before we went there, which is so impressive because these books are, once again, quite long, and we're all quite busy, and most people don't have time to do that. So from the get-go, we kind of knew that was the perfect place to be, because they also didn't want us to, they were like, some places were like, well, you're going to veer off the books, right? And we're like, no, what's the point of doing these books if we're not going to stick to them? So I don't know if that answered your question or if it was the kind of how it came to be Outlander part of it.
Yeah. I'd be just secondhand recounting what she said. I remember she said something like, Ron came in and said, here's your series, and dumped down a whole bunch of books on the table. Before I go any further into the story, do you want to elaborate on what that was like?
Well, no, I think it was probably hopefully a little more eloquent than here it is. Ron's slightly more, but it really was. I mean, that's kind of what I was saying. It was like just literally in an individual way showing exactly how much material we had and how much we could do with it and that what a large canvas we had to work with. I don't honestly remember much beyond that. I wonder what I'd have to ask Karen about that, what else went on in that meeting.
Maybe we'll have to ask Karen one day. Meryl, you said one time in an interview, you said with the Hollywood Report, you said, oh God, I don't know if that's not the quote, but you said, we try very hard to keep an historical perspective and try not to bring too much of a contemporary look on Outlander. I think all makes sense, but maybe that doesn't make much sense anymore. We live in a very different place. It's 2020. We've got Black Lives Matter movement. We've had the Me Too movement. I'm wondering if your sentiments have shifted in any way with this tricky thing of balancing the tension between fidelity to the source material and the expectations of your audience, and at the same time being conscious and responsive to feelings and the attitudes of the day. I mean, we've seen other studios, how they've responded to this. So Disney, for example, have recently cast a woman of color in the role of Ariel. Marvel cast Anthony Mackie as Captain America, who's going to be play Captain America. And I'm wondering what your opinion is on this. Is like, do you think, for example, like if you were to cast Outlander in 2020, we could see a person of color playing Jamie Fraser, for example? How are you adapting to this?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we were just starting out, my answer might be different. You know what I mean? If we were just about to cast this, and you know, I think all these changes, however painful right now, that people are going through, I think I'm so optimistic about where we're going. I feel for me that this is a real tipping point in our history. Whereas before I felt like, you know, things have happened. Certainly I was in Los Angeles for the Rodney King riots and what happened to Rodney King. And I don't feel like the shift happened then. Like, I feel like it's happening now, which I think is, for me, so uplifting in so many ways. And I think for us, you know, Matt and I have had a lot of conversations about things that we want to do to try to make changes. And I'd rather our actions speak for us than I'm very sensitive to the fact that so many people are talking about this and coming out in support of Black Lives Matter, which I think is so important. But I think our actions are even more important. I think it's easy to on Instagram or Twitter show your support, and we all should. But I think it's what we do down the line that's going to be the most important. And I think internally, and there are a lot of changes we'd like to make, and we'll do so as we go forward. This might be different if we were just casting Outlander right now. I don't know what my opinion would be there. You know, we're going into our sixth season. Things are set. You know, we are trying to follow Diana's books, which is a work of fiction, obviously, but based on a real time in history. And I do think, you know, we'll still do the same thing. I don't know. I'm not sure if we would have done something different. Perhaps maybe if we were back in the stories we told in season four, where there was more an emphasis on being at Joe Costa's plantation, where things were so painful for Claire and there was so many issues of slavery. Because I do think we felt that it was important to show, not sugarcoat that. You know, we didn't go as far as we could have, but we felt like there was a brutality to it that some people complained about. But quite honestly, I think you do have to sometimes show things in that way. Just like I wouldn't want people to say the Holocaust never existed or certain things never existed. I think it is important to show things as they truly happened. Same as I kind of feel about the Me Too movement right now. I don't think Outlander is about the Me Too movement. I think it's about showing his period in time where, unfortunately, women were not seen in the same light as men were. And it wasn't right, but that's what happened. And I think going back and changing that history is wrong in some ways, because it's saying that didn't happen. It's not reminding people where we can be again if we don't change our actions. I think it's important to have a person like Claire Frazier or Brianna to show that these people, these women who were from a certain time, are now placed in this time and are being active in a way that women couldn't be as active in that time. But, you know, certain other characters, I don't think you'd want them to be so outspoken in a way that seems different to that time, because we do want to show that time in a realistic way. And other projects we do, I think we'll show in different ways that, you know, hopefully we can make a difference in the world and a difference to all of our communities and show our support in other ways.
I wanted to say, I really do agree with what you were saying emphatically. I think there's a quote, I can't remember who said it, but you know, history is important because without learning about history, we're doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past, right? And there's obviously a fictional element to Outlander, but there's an historical one, and we can't just erase our history. I think there has it's a very good learning potential, and we have a duty there to respect those things. And I think Outlander has done a really good job of portraying the horrors of the past. And I think that, I don't know, it's a very, very tough thing to negotiate in this time.
No, it's true. I mean, we haven't been perfect for sure. I mean, looking back, there are tons of things I'm sure we could have or would have changed. It's hard to look back, and, you know, I think we can only look forward and kind of figure out what we're going to do as we go.
Outlander is in its sixth season now, which in TV years means this creative baby of yours is, you know, well and truly left home. It's blamed you for all its problems and, you know, asks you to do its dirty laundry every now and then. And you've said many times, we'll keep making this as long as Diana keeps writing it. But again, times have changed. We're all worried about the future. And in the light of the challenges facing film and TV world from COVID, do you still maintain that same sense of hope and optimism about the future of Outlander and our industry? And can you maybe explain the logistical challenges of keeping a show running this long, and especially now in this COVID world?
Yeah, I mean, I continue to say that as long as Diana is writing these books, we'll continue. You know, how much longer everyone wants to do it, I don't know. And certainly, you know, in book 9, which is coming out soon, I can't remember how old Jamie and Claire are, but they're getting up there. You know, so I mean, certainly we might run into some issues at that point, but, you know, we are actively talking about continuing doing these seasons. It's certainly something that we're talking about with Starz and Sony, obviously with everything that's going on right now. Everything's been a little slowed down. We are going to be shooting season 6. That has been slowed down as well. You know, we will come back once we feel like it's safe to do so for our crew and our cast. You know, we don't have the kind of show, unfortunately, that can be COVID friendly. That's something that a lot of studios are talking about, and some shows have the luxury to do that. We do not. It's the least COVID friendly show ever. It means that maybe there's no kissing, there's no interaction, there's no there's not a lot of actors and extras.
Doesn't sound friendly at all, does it? Sounds pretty lonely.
It's the kind of show where you only want one guy that's walking down a lonely road. So honestly, we it's been a conversation that's been happening since everyone kind of shut down. But we're still here, and I think we'll still be here. So hopefully, you know, we'll get a couple more seasons going. I love, and hopefully we'll be making this for a long time. You never know what other things could come up. Lord John, various other, you know, the Tryon show. Who knows?
Exactly. You know, hey,
both sound very COVID friendly.
Tryon show. What is COVID friendly? Probably he's just sitting in his office all day.
Well, this is it. Although he wouldn't want to be in New York right now. So, like, yeah, here we go in New York. Oh, hang on.
But not a lot of kissing there. Not a lonely man walking down the street. That sounds, I could see that. The Tryon show right now. Hey, the three of us could start producing it.
Totally.
I think we've all proved right now we've got
it. We can do it right here.
What a producer is.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Wonderful. Well, Meryl, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time and your insight. So thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure to get to chat to you, to get to know you a little bit as well. So, well, from all of us at Outcast, well, me and David, obviously, thank you very, very much indeed for your time.
Well, thank you, guys. It was a pleasure.
Hello, and now we have reached the part of the show where we answer our listeners' questions. It's going to be me and you at the moment, Meryl. Dave, I've actually sent David out for a Frappuccino. So would you want anything?
No, but I honestly, when I think of David, I don't think of him as a Frappuccino guy.
That's for me. I think he's going to have like a kind of skinny mocha latte.
Yes.
He's needs very like light. Yeah, very light on that. And then an egg white omelette, and then he's done. But he's got quite big hands, so he can carry quite a lot. So if there is anything, let me know. Good. Okay. We'll just keep you informed. We've got a couple of letters that we're gonna read out, and some good fun ones. But before we begin, I was going to ask you, what is the oddest thing that anyone has ever suggested to you in regards to the show? Now, obviously, there's a lot of people who've read the books; they know the story. But there's a lot of audience that haven't read the books. So, have you had any odd suggestions as to what should happen?
I don't know if I've had any odd suggestions, really, because I feel like most of our hardcore fans are book fans. You know, a lot of people do have suggested that Sam Heughan play his son, William, as he grows older. Obviously, probably coming off of the fact that the great Tobias Menzies played dual roles. Yes. You know, and obviously this season we also have the twins being played by the same actor as well, Paul. So, but you know what? That would be very difficult. One, the reason it obviously worked with both the twins and with Blackjack and Frank is because they are literally described as one being identical and two, Frank and Jack looking very similar or almost identical. So that worked. You know, with Sam playing dual roles, not only would it be very difficult to do because Sam is obviously in quite a bit as Jamie, but also, you know, Sam and his son shouldn't look exactly alike. And while Sam is quite young looking, could he play 19? I don't know. Maybe, you know,
just get your hands on Scorsese's Ageifier. Exactly. for the Irishman. Well, maybe that's the key.
That's the other thing. People think that's so easy, but, you know, we did that a little with Duncan Lacroix, in Murtaugh this season, and it's unbelievably expensive. So, I'm thinking maybe you should play, Jamie's son, William. Why not? We don't see Tryon again.
Exactly. Come on. There's an opening. There's an opening here. Well, we have actually got a couple of suggestions from a couple of listeners. So I was going to run these past you and see if any of these could float. Some of them are brilliant, I have to say. Some, well, let's just wait and see. This one's from Kathy in St. Paul in Minnesota. And she's asking, will Murtaugh make a return, perhaps as a zombie? And then she goes on to say, maybe a long lost brother or a relative, although she does say that the zombie is her best idea. Any road in that?
Oh my God, I love the idea of zombie Murtaugh. I mean, it's brilliant, actually. And I mean, a zombie Murtaugh just showing up at dinner parties, just showing up on the ridge occasionally.
I mean, amazing.
I think it's brilliant. I love it.
I think it's great.
I will talk to the writers and Matt Roberts immediately.
Throw it in. Just see. You know, put it in their good hands. I'm sure they can do it. Okay, now John in Manchester in England asks about possible spin-offs. And he's got a few suggestions for titles.
Ready.
One, Jamie's Kitchen, and the other one, Frasier, which I think both those titles have been taken. And the other one was Claire's Accessories, which actually I think is more like a home improvement show. It's also a shop over here that sells earrings. So I don't think John has particularly done his homework.
Doing his research
on that.
Well,
one.
Can we go back to the second suggestion, Frasier? I mean, is that just an all-encompassing? Is that about anything specific, or it's just Frasier?
I think he's working on the assumption that because he's called Jamie Frasier, that they could do a show called Frasier. Maybe at a barroom situation, maybe with a slight kind of time hitch thing again, but he ends up in Boston, sitting at the end of a bar wearing a kilt and answering questions.
Yeah, it's actually quite a brilliant. You just see Jamie at the end of the bar, Sam giving him suggestions over beer.
Yeah, exactly. And relationship advice, which would, I mean, perfect. It's perfect, really. He's actually got some others, which these are brilliant. Okay. Now I think you should get a pen because these are exceptional. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Here we go. First one, Richard's Rankings, where Richard Rankin organizes his favorite things in order of preference and size.
I love that it's not my preference, but it's also size.
It's size.
And by the way, yep. I almost want to suggest that to Richard because I really feel should. Like he would love that.
I mean, Richard's Rankings. This is, honestly, this is that. I'm sure they do this at Bravo.
I feel like I want to hire this person.
This one is brilliant. Helter Skelton, a show where Sophie Skelton rides the world's biggest roller coasters.
Oh my God, brilliant. And I'm sure Sophie would love that. It's just like we could send her, you know what? Men in Kilts has nothing on Sophie's Helter Skelton and going around to different venues to ride roller coasters.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the best part of that is that she really hates it. doesn't want to do it, but is contractually obliged to get on the roller coaster. And I think there should be one at least in somewhere in Eastern Europe that you would go, I do not want to go on this.
This seems very rickety. This seems very rickety.
Exactly. I didn't realize they could still be made of wood. Things like that. Excellent. And then the last one, which is a bit of a dark one, but I like it nonetheless, is called For Whom the Bell Tolls. And that's where John Bell visits old age homes across the Isle of Mull, which I think a bit niche.
I feel like, call me crazy, but that's maybe the one I'm least interested in.
That's crazy. I don't know. I don't know why. I just thought it was endless. Surely to go.
Endless fun. Endless fun.
Endless fun. Endless fun. But how do you find shows to make? Do people come to you with, say, an idea, or does certain people come to you, or do you just happen across it somewhere and you go, that's it?
It depends. I mean, certainly with the world of Outlander, obviously we've got a lot of material at our fingertips. So there's quite a wealth of stuff to kind of talk about, you know, in terms of a Lord John series or whatever it might be. But in terms of outside Outlander, it's a variety of ways. Either sometimes I will read books and think, God, this would be a great series. Or, you know, sometimes Ron and I, we get different things that are submitted to us. It depends with whatever studio we're with. Things are submitted to them and then they come to us. So it just depends. Or you read an article, or, you know, you hear something on the radio. There's so many different ways. So it's a variety of different different avenues by which we find material.
Okay. And have you had any real left field suggestions? For instance, I was doing a little bit of research on strange TV shows, and there's a show here which was made in 1983, and I can't even be, it made, it did, they made 13 episodes of this show. I should want to say that now. They made 13 episodes of this. It's called Dial an Ape. It's a sitcom. It's a sitcom about an orangutan that becomes a political advisor. And it ran for 13 episodes.
That is amazing. But I mean, isn't that the world of reality TV we're in right now? That anything could be an episode? That anything could be an episode of television or a series? I mean, you and I talk, you're doing a podcast, you and David. Yeah. Did you ever think people would want to listen to you two?
Yes, absolutely. Week in, week out, thank you. But yeah, it's extraordinary. Like there was a show over here called The Farm, and they had Vanilla Ice on it, who then became a farmer and had to milk cows and other things you do with bulls, which was a very strange thing to see in the sort of late 90s. Vanilla Ice down on the farm. Very strange.
That seems so kind of like John Bell going to visit people
in old age homes across the Isle of Mull. There could only be two, I'm imagining. So it's a short window. But is there a particular sort of passion project that you have had? Like, for instance, you know, many producers and directors have a sort of passion project that at some point they would like to do. Either the time isn't right, or it just hasn't happened. Like, for instance, you know, Barry Levinson worked on Toys for 20 years before he did it with Robin Williams. And obviously Terry Gilliam, someone who I adore, spends years and years to try and get his vision out there. I mean, do you have a passion project that you think, at some point, I would really like to make this?
Well, actually, Outlander was that passion project. I mean, I didn't have to wait 20 years to make it, but, 10 years ago, whatever it was, when Matt Roberts first introduced me to the books, I immediately thought, oh, I would love to. This was my idea of a great TV series. It's got something for everyone. It's got love, great scope, adventure. It just was right up there with something that I thought, oh, I would love to make this. This would be my idea of a perfect project. And I've been fortunate enough to have gotten to make that project. You know what I mean? Not many people get to make the project that they have a great passion for. I'm currently searching for my next passion. I mean, Outlander is my great love at this point, but eventually it will end. I don't know when. I'm hoping we can do this for a few more years, but I'm in the search for the next great project. You've certainly thrown out a few key ones that I'm definitely going to be thinking about.
You should. All I ask is a finder's fee. I think that's quite fair for some of these quite exceptional titles there. That's what I'm going to bring up. When you look for projects, are they themed? Like, you've done a lot of sci-fi. So are you looking for something with that bent, or are you going to just kind of looking for a really good story that has to be told?
I actually do the opposite. I find so many people, because I'm Ron and I are producing partners, so many people bring us sci-fi stories. And in fact, I think that's how Outlander came about, is that I was looking for to do something that was outside of that, because people think Ron is a sci-fi guy, and he is, and he loves it. But he's capable of doing so much more. And I think what I bring to the table is projects that are kind of outside what people normally think he would do. So that's why I always have my eye on those kind of things that are outside the sci-fi realm. Even though I enjoy sci-fi, I mean, I love Star Wars, you know, Star Trek, I love all of those things, but I think there's so many different kinds of projects out there to do. And I think it's great for, you know, our company to be seen to do a diverse roster of programs, not just in the sci-fi world, but as well outside of it.
No, great. I mean, for instance, one of the letters we had here, Mandy in Florida wants to know if Outlander in space could be a thing. Oddly, quite a few people have actually asked about Outlander in space. So I'm just saying, don't rule it out just yet.
Well,
we
do have another project right now called For All Mankind, which revolves around the NASA program. And several people have offered up this idea of doing a mashup, a little kind of crossover For All Mankind, Outlander mashup. I don't know how that would work. But could we see zombie Murtaugh in space? Brilliant.
There you go. These things are, honestly, it's all going to come together beautifully. Dovetail. It's going to dovetail beautifully.
The show almost writes itself.
It does. Have you ever, and this is something I would find very interesting, have you ever pretended to do a different job, or even pretended to be someone else to get out of a hard sell from, say, an actor or a writer or a director? You know, someone comes over and says, "Oh, this is Jackson, my friend. He's an actor," and you've gone, "Oh God, another actor." Actually, I work in this instead. I'm not who you think I am. No, that's we look the same, but not that.
I don't know if I have ever done that, but I will say it is always helpful, because obviously I live in the United States. I spend a good deal of time in Scotland, but as you know, we are not a SAG show. We are an equity show. So it is very helpful when I'm in the States and any American actor comes up to me and, asks to be an Outlander. And it's an easy answer to say, well, actually, we're not SAG. So that's not even a possibility. So, and in the UK, honestly, no one even knows who I am.
See, that's good. That's good. I mean, not to blow my own trumpet, I actually once tried to pass myself off as a semi-professional BMX champion. The only problem I did have was I actually was talking to someone who was a BMX champion, which you really think, how on earth is that a thing? But there you go.
Why?
Sometimes they catch up with you.
Why?
Sometimes they catch up with you.
That profession of all professions.
Because I thought it was so random that I could get away with it. It sounds quite cool. Semi-professional BMX champion. People would go, wow, I don't know a lot about it, which is a good thing because you're lying. And it sounds like you're cool. Sounds like a cool person to be around. Not, of course, if you're then meeting someone who is a professional BMX champion and they say, oh, amazing, have you got the new that new spoke thing? What about the new pedal? Are you going, I have no idea what you're talking about. Don't even own a bike.
But that's an actor thing. I don't think most normal people go around pretending they're other things. Do you know what I mean? Like, most normal people are not passing themselves off as other people. It's actors who think of these kind of things, who think, you know what, I'm going to be so-and-so today.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. And I think I would have made a very good BMX, semi-professional BMX BMX champion.
I can just see it. I can see it. There's a show there somewhere almost.
There is. I tell you, there really is. And the last suggestion that somebody had was Outlander Underwater. Aqualander.
Aqualander. Oh, brilliant. I have not thought of that. We have thought of Petlander, however. Being a show, I think it'd be fascinating to do an animated show of all the animals on Outlander. And from their perspective, Petlander.
Oh, yes, very nice. Very and very COVID friendly.
Animated.
They can get as close as they want. Nice. I like it. Well, actually, we're gonna unpack the underwater one. As I think, genuinely, I think it could have legs. It's been sent in by a Tom Dorney. Sounds very credible. Sounds very credible indeed. But not to be too overconfident, he says it's the next Emmy nominated juggernaut. So. Just going to see how this one plays out. But he says it's a masterwork and it's going to be huge. So here goes. So his idea for this particular show, the lead, a handsome early 40s Englishman. Interesting. A playful glint dances about his swarthy features, accented by a luscious moustache. I mean, don't know who on earth could that be? He goes on. So under the ocean, sea levels have risen. New York is now underwater, but people have learned to adapt, and a brave Scottish community, spurned from the above world, now live in harmony under a large bubble dome called Big Dome. But wait. Things start happening, and a new person has joined. Saviour or destroyer, we don't know yet. Our furiously handsome Englishman has arrived. He's got some crazy ideas. So do they join him, or do they remain? He has said the pitch would be, it's Waterworld meets Chinatown, meets Apocalypse Now.
Well, I mean, you lost me at Waterworld a little bit, only because, as we all know, a slightly problematic film. But can we go back a little bit? Can we just rewind a little bit? Because
yes, of course.
Let's just start off with our protagonist, this English fellow.
Yes.
You know, just starting off there, this whole Scottish-themed show and having an Englishman as a protagonist is interesting. Very interesting, and I'm wondering where this idea, you know, came from, the origins of it. Then I'd love to talk about the idea of Big Dome as a name for the place. Is that something perhaps a child thought up of, or where did that name come from?
I think this person has a searing intelligence, and I think maybe in about 4 or 5 years, or maybe never in his lifetime. His true genius, much like Van Gogh, will come to fruition again. But I think there's a lot to play with there.
Oh my God! It sounds almost on the level of Aquaman.
Yeah, brilliant. And he wants to call it Trion. There is the law, and there is what is done. And I think that's amazing. That's a winner right there. Boom.
Absolutely. Can I just say though about that line? There's law and there is what is done. I actually say that in my real life all the time. There are a couple lines from Outlander that I find that I just kind of throw out. That is one of them.
Well, I am honored. That is the case. But it is a great line.
It is. It's a very good line, quite with the aplomb you do or you did in the show. But I like to throw it out there.
If nothing else, we're gonna push forward with Trion, the underwater Aqualander that is. So, you know, a lot has come from this. A lot of great, great stuff moving forward.
I think if I was to rank these, though, in terms of preference and size, I'd probably put Richard's rankings maybe first.
Oh, yeah. I think you're right. Although,
followed by just Helter Skelton or whatever that
is. Helter Skelton. Just to see her face when she is just brought to, just like, not again, please, not again. And like half the show would just be her saying, I'm not doing it. And they're just trying to convince her, showing her photos. Yeah, things like, oh.
I'm not sure where I'd rank the Big Dome Aqua Outlander and the John Bell the John Bell series. I'm not sure how I'd rank this.
I'll tell you something, two out of four is a win. And I'm very happy with that. Meryl, thank you so much for your time. It really has been an absolute pleasure. You take away a lot of good ideas, which is fantastic. And it's been an absolute pleasure. I know I speak for David as well, that says thank you so much for your time.
Well, I appreciate it. And thanks for including me in all of these fan letters and questions. It was fascinating. And I feel like I have so much new material to work on at this
point. I'll loop you in on the emails, Mara. I'll let you worry about that.
I'll send you your 5%. So,
perfect. It's a done deal. Wonderful. Meryl, thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Outcasts.
Please remember to rate, subscribe, and leave a review, as it all helps.
Follow us on our Instagram page at outcast.podcast for all the latest updates.
Or you can send us an email at outcastspodcastshow@gmail.com.
Every week, we shall select a question from one of our listeners to answer on the show.
The theme music is composed by Kieran Ledwidge. All views and opinions expressed on the show are our own and have no affiliation with the series of books written by Diana Gabaldon or the Sony Stars television show Outlander.
No animals were harmed in the making of this podcast. Although I did have a ham sandwich earlier, so...
See you next time.
See you next time.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.